Hello, hello, everybody. Welcome to this episode of Causes or Cures. I'm Dr. Eakes, your host. Thank you so much for joining in, no matter where you are in the world. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I'm glad you're here. Hope you're doing okay with all this pandemic stuff. So, for 2022 and maybe beyond, I don't know, I wanted to focus on a few topics that I'm passionate about. One of them being industry's influence on public health policy, healthcare policy, regulatory bodies, political bodies, and people, maybe patient groups, that kind of thing. What I really wanted to know is, how deep is this influence? How big is it? How many people and organizations fall under its umbrella? From this podcast going forward, I'm going to bring on researchers who study this and talk to them about it and see what they're finding in their studies. So some of you know I've worked as a federal contractor during the COVID-19 response. I've been working on the public health response. It's been an interesting experience for sure, but a theme that I've noticed that I can't ignore is just this lack of trust in traditional scientific authorities, healthcare providers, agencies, literature. There's a growing lack of trust, and I said that's interesting. And at the same time, there's this whole war on misinformation, and these two to me are related. In fact, I just wrote a blog on my health blog at bloomingwellness.com titled, "I don't think it's a misinformation problem as much as it is a trust problem." So you can read that there. But this idea of trust, and my theory is that this could be related to the topic that I want to focus on, which is industry's influence on healthcare, public health agencies, that kind of thing. Because, you know, if people don't know who to trust, or if they don't trust you anymore, and you are the scientific authorities, well, that's a problem. And I think it's important to explore why there is that lack of trust. You know, why someone might trust a podcast host versus a healthcare provider, or versus a peer-reviewed journal. Just pointing your finger at someone and saying, you need to trust them and not them. Well, that's not going to work. I mean, heck, if you've ever been cheated on, you know that doesn't work. If you stop trusting someone and then you're told to trust them, you're going to be like, well, no. And what about all these fact checkers, right? Fact checking, it's like this booming new profession. I don't even know who the fact checkers are. I don't know who funds them. Does industry fund them? I have no idea. The only time I have ever thought about fact checkers before is when I was a little girl. I went to Catholic school and the nuns were the fact checkers. I had no doubt about that. The nuns were the fact checkers. And the misinformers were all the atheists and the Protestants especially, and those poor schmucks all went to hell. But anyways, I have no idea who the fact checkers are. And at the end of the day, I don't really know why people might trust, you know, one person over another, but I just thought this was worthy of exploration, and my hypothesis is that this lack of trust could have something to do with this umbrella of industry influence on public health, healthcare, health policy, all of that stuff. So my guest today is Dr. Lisa Parker, who is an honorary lecturer at the School of Pharmacy at the University of Sydney in Australia. Her research focuses on public health ethics, particularly the influence industry has on healthcare policy and practice. She is also a practicing medical clinician who works in the field of oncology. She wrote a paper recently that I read, and it was called, "There Are Ways Drug Companies Will Get Into DTC Decisions." Now, DTC in this context refers to drug and therapeutics committees, essentially, and she's going to go into this in more detail, but essentially a body of people that make decisions about what drugs and therapeutics are used in a hospital. So I thought this was a really interesting topic, and she's going to talk about all the ways that industry influences that process in Australia, and ways that the committee tries to stop that influence, and then the ways that the drug companies get around those mitigation efforts, so to speak. So Let's connect to Dr. Parker in Australia and hear what she has to say on this topic. All right, guys, 1 second here.
I'm excited to chat with you today.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
And so I was happy we were able to connect. You are in Sydney and it's early there, and it's mid-afternoon here. Well, starting to get towards evening, but I'm always so interested in the drug companies and kind of how they influence healthcare and healthcare decisions and what medications get used and what don't. And I know our systems are a little different, but there's lots of similarities. So when I read your paper, there are ways drug companies will get into DTC decisions, how Australia's Drug and Therapeutics Committee addresses pharmaceutical industry influence. I guess to start off, do you mind explaining briefly what a DTC is and what it does?
Sure, yeah. It's interesting, actually. I mean, I have to say, before I did this study, I don't think I'd ever really heard of a DTC, and I certainly didn't know what they do, you know, and that's despite working in hospitals for many years. So they're kind of a little bit behind the scenes, perhaps for the average healthcare worker, but very important role. So essentially what they do is they sit within an institution or across a variety, you know, a kind of a region with multiple institutions, and they really oversee the use of medications within the institutions in their remit. So they monitor access and they monitor the sort of use that the medications can have. So in the private world, for instance, if you've got a solo practitioner, they can prescribe, well, certainly in Australia, and I think it's similar in the US, they can prescribe things that are for a particular indication. You can also prescribe off-label to a certain extent. You can prescribe things that are subsidised by governments or insurance companies, and you can prescribe things that aren't subsidised by private prescriptions. So you've got quite a lot more leeway when you're a solo practitioner. But when you work in an institution, you have to abide by the guidance of that institution, and that includes what you are allowed to prescribe and the indications for which you prescribe it. So the committee sits down regularly and they make decisions about what medications are so-called on formulary. So what they hold in the pharmacy within their institution or their region that are able to be prescribed, and they have very prescriptive guidelines about the reasons you can prescribe those medications. So you might have drug X and you can use it for disease Y under these circumstances, but you can't just use it willy-nilly for diseases A, B, and C as well. So they have quite strict guidance. They make decisions about what drugs they think should be held within their institution based on, for example, the population. So if there are some common diseases within their local area, they will be more likely to include certain drugs. They might not feel the need to include other drugs, mm-hmm. partly based on population, a lot based on the evidence. So they spend a lot of time looking at the benefits and harms, and it's a little bit based on price. They also have the discretion to allow kind of one-off uses of drugs that either are not routinely kept or that are used for a different indication. So if a particular physician wants to use a drug that wouldn't normally be accepted under their institution committee guidelines, they can apply to the committee and say, "Well, I've got this very sick patient and we really want to try that drug for this indication. What do you think?" So they make they respond quite quickly as well as providing the overall structure to the formulary.
Okay. So kind of, I guess an equivalent in the US would be just an organization that approves the medications that you can use in the hospital.
Yeah, but not only approves, but also provides guidance about when to use it and what drug schedules, you know, and what stock to have in the hospital. So, you know, do you have a 25 milligram and a 50 milligram, or do you just have 25 milligram, you know, and do you give it orally, or do you give it its IV or subcut, you know, so they do provide guidance there as well. And yeah, definitely the US has these committees. They might not necessarily always be called a drug and therapeutics committee, but they definitely have these committees.
Yeah. I think when we see DTC, we think of direct to consumer right away.
Okay, yeah. They might be called a PTC, perhaps a pharmaceutical therapeutics committee. I can't quite recall.
So in your research, you interviewed current and previous DTC members across an area, North South Wales. And
New South Wales, yeah.
And you were looking at ways that they were eliminating drug companies from influencing this process, meaning like what did they have in place, and also ways that drug companies did influence them despite those strategies that they may have had in place. Is that an okay description?
Yeah.
Fair. Okay. So what are they doing now? And we obviously have this issue, you know, over here with, you know, the people wonder, you know, well, should we be using that drug that's very expensive and patented versus this one, you know? So that's why I was really interested in this study, just in terms of, is this system biased at all? But what are they doing now to stop the influence of drug companies, or to suppress it, so to speak?
Yeah, so the people that I spoke with who are sitting on these committees were definitely aware that pharmaceutical industry companies, you know, that they wanted to market their products. They were recipients of some of that marketing, and they were very aware that their job as a committee was to be independent of that marketing. So it was certainly something that on everybody's radar. So the kinds of things that they talked about were, well, we have a system where people who sit on the committee have to declare any conflicts of interest. So either at every meet, it varied depending on who I was speaking to, and clearly varied across committees. So they might have every meeting, some committees might ask all the members, you know, have you got any conflicts of interest to declare that are relevant to this meeting? Or they might just do a one-off when you join, please sign this document and list any conflicts of interest that you might have. Or they might do that annually. So some people that I spoke to said, yeah, it was kind of maybe done at the beginning, but never ever after that. So, and they also said there were no, there was not really any discussion about what that term conflicts of interest meant, what was kind of what they were looking, you know, was it any pharmaceutical industry company? Was it only the company that was producing the product that was being discussed at that meeting? Was there a dollar amount? How recently, you know, would it 5 years ago, last week? You know, there weren't any discussions about the detail there. But they did all have that awareness that conflicts of interest should be declared by members. So that was one thing.
Okay.
Another thing that they did have was when clinicians were applying to the committee for requesting a new drug to be put on formulary, or asking for these special dispensation, they call them individual patient use dispensation for a one-off, those application forms had a section where the applicant should declare their conflicts of interest. So again, they were aware that if you're a clinician, you should be declaring it. But they also said, well, often that's just left blank.
Okay.
Or often the form might be filled in by the registrar or the kind of the trainee who doesn't have any financial links with the pharmaceutical industry. But the person that actually, you know, who really wants this is the senior clinician, and they've got loads of, but you know, they're not signing the form, so they didn't fill in the conflict of interest declaration.
Right.
So they did have systems in place, but it was clear to me, at least, that the systems had loopholes and were not particularly consistent across different committees.
Okay, right. And that makes sense that you would have to account for conflicts of interest on both the decision makers and the applicant.
Yeah. There were some other systems that they had in place. In fact, it's not only those two ways of getting medications into the hospital that the committee has oversight over. So it's the formulary and those special dispensation uses. But the committee also has oversight over any other ways medicines can get into a hospital. So, for instance, a drug company rep might come to a hospital, to a department or a particular clinician and say, I've got all these free samples, here you go. Mm-hmm. Or they might say, I've got a patient familiarization program. Mm-hmm. So, I'm trying to get doctors comfortable with using these new drugs. So for 6 months, I'll give you free access if your patient meets these criteria, or we could do a 2-for-1 deal, or we could pay every second month or something, so that there are these free samples and access programs that exist in all hospitals. And all the committees felt that it was their remit to have oversight over those. So you should, as a clinician, if you're offered these programs or these free samples, you should go to the committee and say, this is what's been offered. And the committee should say, okay, yeah, we're happy with that. We'll put that free sample in the pharmacy. Or look, you know what, that program, it might look good for 2 months, but what happens at the end of 2 months, we're going to have to end up paying for it. And we don't actually think this is the best medication. So we're going to say no to that familiarization program. So they have oversight, but the committee people that I spoke to were also aware that often, not often, but they certainly knew of many examples where those medications came into the hospital without telling the committee. So again, there were loopholes and problems with the system.
So I thought the most interesting part in your study to me was the table 4, kind of the ways that the drug companies are able to influence this process. So I wanted to talk a little bit about those. Number one, so the application for a medication is supposed to come from a senior medical staff, but that doesn't, in your research, that didn't always happen. Is that correct?
Probably rarely happens, to be honest.
it's supposed to happen, but it rarely happens.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a senior clinician. They're not going to typically spend a lot of time filling in forms. So, they might. So it might either be the drug company rep who fills in the form, and there were certainly plenty of people who told me that was common. And the drug company rep might even come up with the idea as well. They might say, we've got this new drug, what do you reckon? And the senior doctor will say, okay, that sounds fine. And the drug company rep will say, yeah, okay, so I'll fill out a form and I'll collate all the evidence and you sign it here. Yeah, that's fine. That's either the drug company rep, or it might be the clinician who says, I think we want this new drug. You're my senior trainee, you do all the paperwork and I'll just send it in.
Okay.
I mean, occasionally it's the seniors, but I think probably
it's less rarely. Okay. And it could be due to time constraints, but it could just be due to the drug company rep pushing it, like, I'll fill it out. So that's a good segue. There's on these forms, there's a section for evidence. And oftentimes that is filled out by, I don't know if often the right word, but it happens that it's filled out by the pharmaceutical representative.
Yeah. So that was interesting. I mean, the point is that the applicant is supposed to collect all the relevant evidence and then send it to the committee, and the committee will then look through it. Now, if the drug company rep is doing that, then they're likely, this is what participants told me, it's clear that they only collect a certain section of the evidence, mostly evidence that they've funded and created, and they were confident that drug company reps were only going to put the evidence that showed their drug in a beneficial light. Now, the committees are supposed to be able to go through the evidence independently, so they're supposed to be able to go and look for more evidence, and I think in the US, perhaps committees are, at least sometimes, a better resource to do that. But certainly in Australia, the committees are pretty stretched. So they did have a committee, typically would have one pharmacist whose role it was to work that committee, who could go away and search for additional evidence that the committee could review. But the reality was they didn't always have the time to do that in a very thorough way. So if you are relying on the evidence that's produced with the application, then it may be that all you see is what the drug company wants you to see.
Okay, so biased. And I found a section in your paper interesting, and I guess it was some of the people you interviewed were saying, sometimes it's obvious to doctors or people on the committee that it's biased, and they're like, no, wait, there's other evidence out there. Like we need to include that.
But that's dependent again on having a motivated pharmacist who's got enough time to do that.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing. There isn't a lot of time. So that would be an extra task that would be hard to do.
That's right.
Now we talked a little bit, you already mentioned the financial ties, the conflicts of interest. Basically, those were just not clearly defined in what you'd have to list. I wanted to ask you about, and we have these all the time over here, promotional lunches, that kind of thing. Now, is that considered, it's so commonplace, right? But what happens at these promotional lunches related to this process?
Yeah, it doesn't make me particularly popular with my colleagues talking about this, as you can imagine. You're a busy hospital doctor and someone's offering to pay you lunch for your lunch. I mean, you know, it's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
And you're confident, you're an upstanding, you know, you're confident that doesn't influence you. Why would it? But we just know from evidence that it does, and it might not be a conscious thing. Or maybe it is a conscious thing and you think, well, I've got two equivalent drugs and, you know, I really like the rep from this company, so I'll use that one. Or they've promised us great things for the patients. Or, you know, it works. I mean, if it didn't work, they wouldn't do it all the time. So it is commonplace. But there is evidence to show that it influences prescribing and that, you know, overall it reduces the quality of prescribing at a kind of a global or a kind of an institutional level. So by reducing the quality, I mean you might be more likely to prescribe a brand name rather than a generic, and you might be more likely to prescribe these newer drugs rather than older drugs that are equivalent, and you might be more likely to prescribe expensive products. So there are alternatives, I guess. And certainly in Australia, and I don't know about the US, but in Australia there are educational sessions called academic detailing, where you might get an independent person, perhaps from university or whatever, going around to the general practices and talking about new products in an independent way. I mean, you know, that's kind of a no-brainer, really, when you think about it. Instead of 20 drug reps going and spruiking their products, you know, without kind of talking about the competitor products or the possible side effects or the lack of gaps in the evidence. You know, it's such an important part of medicine, prescribing medication. You just think it doesn't make sense to have an independent person getting everybody up to date on a regular basis.
But does the independent person provide lunch or not?
Well, no. Well, I mean, what is this? You know, we're not that important that we need lunch. You know, we have this mindset that still we're really important and busy and we need lunch. Well, I'm thinking, well, you know, I think probably a lot of people would quite like to say that. And I know we're important and busy or whatever you want, but really, anyway, so no, the independent person won't provide lunch because there's no funding for it. And that is a problem. And, you know, some of the people that I spoke to in these hospitals said, you know, we'd really like to get the drug company rep out of the hospital. And actually the WHO says the drug and therapeutics committee should have oversight over that kind of marketing in their institutions.
Oh, interesting.
But the people I spoke with, the people I spoke with said, well, it's just not our remit. We have no authority over that. But WHO is very clear that it is the committee who should be able to have responsibility there. And the people I spoke with said, look, we've tried to get someone else to pay for the lunch. You know, the hospital has often has grant money or whatever, but They're not allowed to use it for lunches. I guess it's not a good look. And you think, well, it's not a good look, but, you know,
that's
anyway.
True. Yeah. A lot of rules with grants. You can't pay for food over a certain amount. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think we're doing ourselves and we're doing our public a disservice, really, because it would pay for itself in the long run. I think we all know that. We would be less likely to be using these expensive products if we didn't have people spruiking them in the hospital tea rooms.
What are tea rooms?
Oh, so many departments, of say an anaesthetic department or the operating theatres, might have a little room where people can get a cup of tea and a coffee and a biscuit in between theatre cases or whatever. Department, there might be a room with a microwave and a boiler where you can heat up your lunch and get a cup of coffee.
Okay, so like a lounge.
Yeah.
Okay, so and then in the paper you said sometimes the drug company reps will come right in the tea room.
Yeah, so they'll sit there because people will come in and out of those little rooms in between clinics or operating lists or whatever. So it's just a sort of central area within the department where people might congregate. So they'll sit there and people can come and listen to the drug rep while they're getting their cup of coffee and having a biscuit.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I guess I was just thinking of the logistics. And I know here in the hospitals, I mean, drug reps go in and out of hospitals, doctor's offices. They're always, you know, driving around. That's their job. I can't imagine that would be really hard to control, keeping the drug reps out of the hospital. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is difficult, and you probably couldn't keep them out of the pharmacy, to be honest, because I think they do need to talk about, kind of the nuts and bolts of it, not so much of the prescribing, but well, we've got this packet and it comes in a blister pack, or we've got this one and it, you have to mix it up with this in order to give it IV. So there may be other kind of logistical things that they have to talk about, you know. And it's not, and this is beyond the scope of my paper, but it's not just the drug reps, it's the medical device reps as well who come in and say, well, this is how you use my new device, and they'll sit in the operating theater and say, oh, you know, that when that happens you have to do this. And so it is very hard to keep industry people out, and you can see that they have a place, but at the same time it may be it may just be time to really have a look at that and either significantly reduce the reasons that they're allowed to come in, or at the very least, according to the participants I spoke to, at the very least monitor who's going in and out, because there's not even any list, you know, there's no way of checking who's going in and out. They don't necessarily have a list of names and dates, and if you had that, then you could do some interesting research on, well, what are the drugs being prescribed and how
frequency.
Does that correlate with you know, is there what's going on here?
Yeah,
but there's none of that.
That would be a very interesting study. And it's not just as you described in the paper, it's not just promotional lunches, it's also dinners, which get a little fancier, and then it's travel to conferences, and the conferences are probably not in like Siberia, they're probably in nice places.
I mean, not that, you know, there's less of that, I think, than there used to be. Certainly, you know, 20, 30 years ago, that was, you know, you'd take your whole family to Hawaii sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So there's less of that, but it's still there to a certain degree. And it's not just the doctors, it's the allied health professionals, so it's the nurses as well, and it's the trainees. So many of the doctors now will have some access to funds that they can use to go to these conferences, but the trainees won't, and the nurses won't, the dietitians won't. So there are still, you know, and they're not necessarily fancy conferences. It might just be the annual update, you know, in Melbourne or something, which is like, you know,
I used a hyperbole there. I said Siberia, but I was expecting I wouldn't go to a conference if it wasn't in a nice place, if I had to travel, but that's just me being.
But you would if you were a trainee. You
maybe,
know?
Yeah.
You
if I, yeah, you no, would. I guess I would if I had to. Yeah, you're right. So the other thing too, and I found this interesting, and I actually wanted to ask for some more clarification on this. Clinical trials, how do drug companies influence that? There was something in there about paying the salaries of the research staff or bringing in, you know, more resources? Where is the influence there happening?
Yeah, so that's an interesting area. You know, and that's much less under the remit of the therapeutics committees, because by and large they don't necessarily look at what's going on in the trials, because often they're multi-center trials anyway. So they do get the ethics committee do have a look at the ethics side of it, but usually nobody looks at the kind of pharmaceutical side of it in the institution, because it's probably been done elsewhere anyway. But the clinical trials. So if you're running a big clinical trial in a hospital, you need staff, you need clinical trial staff to organise consent forms, to check that all the things that the patients are eligible, and you need, there's often a lot of monitoring, and so you'll have a staff member, it's often a nurse, who'll say, okay, it's 3 months, so patient X, Y, and Z are due for their scans or whatever. So there's quite a lot of monitoring for years and years for these trials, and you need all the forms to be signed and this, that, and the other. So you need staff. You know, as the lead clinician, you can't do it yourself, so you need staff, and in order to have staff, you need to pay them. So the drug companies are very aware of that, and so they'll compensate the lead researcher and say, okay, we'll give you X amount of money per patient, and that money will go into their fund and pay for their clinical trial staff. And that's, I think, all, you know, everyone's all quite transparent and it's all above board. But there are some, there were some things about it that led me a little bit of concern. So one of the people that I spoke with said their pharmacist was paid out of that. There was a pharmacist paid out of that. And that clinical trial pharmacist actually sat on the ethics committee. And I thought, well, if that pharmacist knows that their salary is coming from the pharmaceutical industry based on trials, and they're not going to sit on that ethics committee and kind of reject anything, because that's where their salary is coming from. So that seemed a bit odd to me. And the person I was speaking to about that could see where I was coming from, but thought that the staff were at such a distance from actually where their salary was coming from that it wouldn't play into their mind at all. It was sort of went into a pool of funding. But to my mind, I thought that was potentially problematic. And the second thing is, I guess it just creates a level of close relationship if you're a research member with an industry, and a little bit of a dependence on that industry. You know, you've got these staff in your clinical trial unit. The trial might be coming to an end. You don't really want to let your staff go because, you know, they're part of your team.
Sure.
You might want another trial I just think it creates a little, the people I spoke with thought it might create a little bit of codependency from the clinicians to on the industry. It's nothing overt. It's just that, you know, you're all working together, and so you're all kind of maybe scratching each other's back a bit. You know, the participants have that concern. It might not always be in the best interest of the patient that the clinicians are quite close with the industry. It's tricky because, you know, we all rely on clinical trials to generate evidence.
Right, right. And the drug companies have the money to fund them.
Drug companies have the money to fund the trials, and many of the trials are very well conducted. But there may be some benefit in perhaps having a little bit of distance between the reps and the prescribing clinicians.
Sure, that makes sense. One of the anecdotes I wrote down here is something that someone said was a clinician actually gave the slideshow presentation that was only slides from the drug company, and he didn't make the slide. Was this at like a presentation? That probably didn't go over too well.
Yeah, well, interesting. So the person who told me about that was a trainee who was giving a talk about a new, I actually don't know what it was about, but presumably about a new product or a new trial, if they were drug company slides, and was just using the company slides. And the person I spoke to was just very unhappy with that. But, you know, you're a busy trainee. You've been asked to give this talk. You don't really want to give it. Drug company rep says, I'll just give you a slide. It'll be fine.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But it creates that sense in the tea room. Sorry, I didn't realize tea room was an Australian phrase today. Creates that sense in the room, the lunch room maybe, that this is normal and it's very normalized. And you said yourself, you know, it's so common to have industry in the hospital. It's so common to have the drug rep providing the lunch, having a little chat at the beginning about their new products, the person giving the talk who's your colleague in the hospital or doctor, but is using company slides. It's just normal. And there were many participants in this study that I spoke to who were very unhappy with that normalizing and felt that really we needed as a profession to do better. We needed to be independent and not have the industry in the hospital and as our best friends or in the lunchroom so often.
It's funny, I can relate to that. When I was getting my master's of public health degree, I worked as a medical writer, a contract medical writer on the side, just to make extra money to help get through school. And I can relate to this so much because I made a lot of slide decks for drug companies. I ghost wrote papers for doctors who it was their name. We knew which journal we were going to submit this to. I would work with the doctor. The doctor was, the name of the doctor was given to me by the drug company. And I would write the paper. I would, you know, use the evidence. The drug company approved it. I would send to the doctor. He would say, okay, sure. And then we'd submit it. I would submit it to the journal. And, and there was also ties to the editorial board. I didn't even know that this, you know, and looking back, I'm like, yeah, that was probably not super above board, you know? I mean, it is a little bit misleading, but this whole, the whole ghostwriting thing, I think for medical journals, especially, but I definitely did that. There's a lot of influence. I mean, and then just the promotional, the continuing medical education and coming up with slide decks for those. And I don't know. There just a lot of influence, I guess.
There's a huge amount of influence. And, you know, we talk about evidence-based medicine, but, you know, what are we really, if the evidence is not independent, if the evidence is biased, then what are we letting ourselves in for, you know, in the health sector? What are our patients getting? They're getting what's good for the industry, you know, and to a certain extent, there's some alignment of what's good for the industry is good for the patient, but not all, you know. The industry is also interested in making money, and they're also interested in new products, and they're less interested in uncovering side effects and clarity around safety profiles of new products. And they're very certainly not interested in cutting costs or reducing to being efficient.
Right.
I don't think it's in our public's best interest that there is that much industry involvement.
I agree with you there. Mm. Which brings me to my next question. Do you think the way that this system or this influence that we're talking about now, is it, you know, biasing the use of the medicines that are new, that are more expensive? Are they truly better, or are we leaving, you know, aside drugs that we could be using that might be less costly? Like, what are the practical implications, I guess that's what I'm asking, of this influence, in your opinion?
Yeah, so it does vary a bit. Look, and I know that there have been some spectacular gains in recent years with new products.
Absolutely,
And there's a lot of hype about new drugs. I work in oncology, and there's certainly a lot of excitement about new agents that we just didn't have 20, even 10 years ago. And it's amazing what they can do for a select group of patients sometimes. But, you know, it really is truly a game changer in certain situations, but not all situations. And there's countless examples of the new whiz-bang drug that everyone thought was going to change the world that actually just quietly got dropped because actually they didn't work, or the safety profile was much worse than other existing drugs. So there's lots of drugs that don't do any better than existing products. They cost a lot more. We don't know, or we do know, that they're not as safe. There's lots of that. So it's hard, isn't it? Because we all want that hope. We all, you know, it's like you're going into a room full of pokies and all you hear is the money coming out. So you know that somewhere in there, there's a winner. You don't kind of recognize all the other losers that are there at the time. Mm. And you hang on to the hope of those winners. And, you know, maybe that's the human condition. But I think we can be a bit smarter about it, and a bit more pragmatic about it, and recognize that probably most of the new products are not any better, are either because they're no better or they're worse side effects or they're more expensive. And probably most new products would fit into that, I would say, you know, with some amazing notable exceptions, but nevertheless, yeah, that's the reality.
And I think that's a really powerful statement coming from you, because, you know, I don't know how it is over in Australia, but people here just can't afford, you know, our medication, can't afford our drugs. It's a massive problem. And we keep electing officials. We keep hoping that they'll somehow be able to, you know, lower the drug prices. And it's a real crisis. So this is the other thing. And you wrote a sentence or two on this in your paper. And I've heard this a lot too, when the drug companies will say, oh, well, we have to say, you know, we have these new drugs on the market. They have to cost this much because we have to cover our large R&D, research and development cost. But you seem to imply in the paper that that was not true. Am I getting that?
Yeah. There's some great research by a colleague of mine in Canada. I don't know if you know Joel Lichten, but he's written a lot about pharmaceutical industry, and I know he's written a great paper suggesting that probably the majority of drug company budgets go on marketing rather than R&D. You know, it might not be much, you know, it might be more 50-50, but, you know, like, it's not like 90% is R&D and 10% is budgeting. It's marketing. It's a very high marketing budget that they have. So, look, yes, they do spend money on innovation, but they make enormous profits and they spend a lot of money on marketing. So if we could maybe reduce a bit of that marketing spend or find other ways of getting the R&D without having to have such a lot of marketing spend, then I think we could still get the innovation without getting the spin, really.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the other thing, and then maybe this is a little bit perhaps about outside the remit of what we're talking about, but there's a lot of focus, and you're right, in Australia it's the same, on new products and whether we can afford them and why can't we afford them, and there's these new things. You know, if we just had a tiny bit of the budget that we spend on medication going more towards public health, you know, and I know we've seen a lot of public health interest in the last couple of years, but if there was a bit more interest in stopping smoking, improving our environment so that they were more friendly for exercise, you know, that kind of stuff actually would make a massive difference to the public's health, much more so than funding one new kind of hopefully miracle drug, really. You know, and you can't have all or nothing. I mean, you still got to have those miracle drugs, and for one or two people, they will mean the world. Mm-hmm. But at a population level, I think the huge focus that is fueled by the pharmaceutical industry on drugs as the answer, you know, somewhat clouds the our understanding and awareness that actually it's all these other things: it's the smoking, it's the exercise, it's the mindset.
Access so to healthy food.
Access.
All of it. I totally agree. And I did do a previous podcast on who dominates the biomedical research agenda with three doctors, two from Argentina, one from Canada. And they talked about this, and just the research agenda is just not there for preventive measures. But I guess the question is, well, maybe the government would fund that, but I don't think a drug company would necessarily fund studies if they didn't see the potential to make money.
No, of course right? not. You know, of course not. I mean, yeah. And that's the other interesting thing about industry-funded research. You know, you can it can be very useful, but it definitely crowds the research agenda. And of course, the drug companies are going to fund the study into, or if they do fund a study, it's on their terms. You know, it's it's how exercise can negate the side effects of this drug. It's not.
Yeah, that's a good point. They're not going to fund, like, you know, the green space project. How to create, you know, safe, viable places to exercise in crowded neighborhoods.
No.
Sponsored by such and such a drug company.
No,
that wouldn't happen. Yeah. Or how to increase access to healthy foods in this neighborhood and that neighborhood.
Yeah, or how to, you know, garner trust in the health system for populations who historically don't trust the health system. And the drug company's not going to have any part of that.
I think that lack of trust, I mean, we have a huge trust problem now. And I think, I always tell people, you know, instead of calling out a lot of the podcasters and a lot of like the little people, like, you know, maybe address some of these issues about the overarching influence and, you know, the driving up of cost of drugs that people can't afford. I wish we would address that with the same kind of enthusiasm. You know what I mean?
It's so hard, isn't it? But
it
as you say,
so
where's the money come from for those studies? And, you know, there'll be a few here and there, and there'll be a few often university groups are funded perhaps by federal government medical research money. But the budget is just minuscule compared to what the industry budget is.
I mean, maybe things will change in the future. I hope to see a better agenda that does address prevention more. But you're right. If there's no money there, it's not going to happen. That's just the way it is.
You know, and to be honest, it's probably politically difficult as well. You know, it's hard for a politician to campaign on the basis of these very hard to measure, quite intangible kind of issues. It's much easier to run a campaign based on, I'm going to improve access to this really important drug that's going to save lives for people with some kind of very high profile disease, you know.
Yeah,
like that's something
true.
People can hang on to. There's people at the end of that. I was just getting a little bit pessimistic here now.
But it's true. I always tell people, like, I always say, it's the social determinants of health. And then we just kind of stop there in public health because there's no clear path to kind of like, how do we really tackle these issues? Like, isn't it time to really get on this? But we just, we mention it like, we know it's a cause, but then we really don't do anything about it. Yeah. There's been some initiatives, you know, I mean, First Lady Michelle Obama, she tried with the obesity initiative, which was a good effort. But again, like once she left, like things like that, you know, they simmer down or there's no funding. It's just, I don't know. I mean, maybe it has to come from the population, like just such a demand, like we need better food access. We need better, you know, food quality, or from the communities, you know, like a grassroots push. It's hard.
I agree. But I think, you know, in the meantime, I think we really do need to make sure we've got tight oversight and regulation around what the industry is doing. And so I guess that's what I was trying to highlight in this paper, that you know, that we need to pay attention to these kinds of rules and regulations and policies and practice, and we really need to kind of be a little bit smarter about that, because if we're not, then the industry is just going to run roughshod over all of us.
I know you have to go soon, so my last question has to do with what would your recommendations be, if you have some specific, can't say that word, specific recommendations to make this process better?
So when I was thinking about this after doing the study, you know, and looking at what all the participants said and sort of having, I guess, a general drawing on what I also knew about this, I guess I came up with a few layers of strategy, which kind of targeted at the various different stakeholders, for want of a better word. So, you know, the committees themselves, I would encourage the chair of the committee to make sure they've got a policy about conflicts of interest that they stick to. You know, write it down. How often are you going to ask for members to talk about it? Have a little bit of education or discussion around the table. What do we mean by this? How many, and if somebody does have a conflict, what are they going to do? Are we just going to say, oh, okay, great. Well, we've written it down. Good, let's move on. Or are we going to say, okay, well, you probably need to be out of the room for this one. Or maybe you should consider getting rid of those financial ties before joining the committee, because otherwise you might just have to step away from the committee. So then I think I would encourage the committees to have really robust discussions and write down policies and stick to them. At the hospital level, I would say maybe get a little bit of chat in the medical admin department or hospital admin department. Who is going to be allowed into your hospital to talk about drugs and under what circumstances? And should we monitor it? Should you monitor, you know, you've got in the US, you've got that great Sunshine Act. Should you monitor, and I think they perhaps do, hope they do, which doctors in your hospital are getting money from drug companies and how much are they getting? And at the same time, which doctors are applying for new drugs and new medical devices? And is there a match there? Is there something going on? If there is something going on, do you want to pull that person in and have a talk about what that? And if it's fine, it's fine. But if it's not, you know, have a little bit of oversight over what your clinicians are doing and who's coming into your hospital. And then I think at the individual doctor level, educate yourself. Work out that it's not necessarily a benign influence having that lunch from the department, from the industry. Think about refusing the lunch. Talk about it with your colleagues. If you're a senior colleague, talk about it with your juniors. Educate your juniors. Universities, educate your medical students about the influence and the possible harms of industry. Health departments, write some policies around this. Give some guidance to your hospital. You know, there's all that, all of those layers, all of those people should be on board having these conversations. I think it's not just a one-off snap your fingers and it's solved. It's an ongoing conversation amongst multiple people at multiple levels.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's not easy.
It's not easy. If it was easy, we'd all be doing it.
Yeah. If it was easy, we wouldn't be doing this podcast. So Dr. Lisa Parker, thank you so much for your time. It was such an interesting discussion. And I welcome you back anytime. I really enjoyed this. And I think you gave a lot of insight. And I really do appreciate you coming on this morning, your morning, my evening.
Well, thanks so much. And thanks for your interest. It was really interesting.
Absolutely. I'm so interested in this topic. So anytime you want to chat, even if it's not a podcast, I'm game. Or I'll go to the tea room. We don't have tea rooms, but I kind of love that now.
All right.
Enjoy the rest of your day. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, guys, thank you so much for joining in for this episode, and a special thank you to Dr. Lisa Parker for joining in. I hope she joins in again and shares some of her other research, because I think it's interesting and I think it's helpful to this overall discussion around lack of trust. Stick around, subscribe. I have more researchers lined up and stakeholders who are going to dive in deeper to different aspects of industry's influence on the system. So tune in, share with your friends, tell me what you thought of this episode, past episodes, future episodes, I don't know. You can reach me at bloomingwellness.com. That's my little territory in the web world, I don't know. All right, I have got to get my dog outside and we are headed down to the river to do a morning workout because I am a bear if I don't work out. So it's a must, but it's great because I play fetch with him and I lift weights and I do all my fun stuff with my resistance bands. I'm always working out, you know, my body and my imagination at the same time. Important. Important. All right, guys. Talk to you soon. Take care. Go outside. Do something good for yourself and others. Talk soon. Bye-bye.